Resilient Cyber Podcast brings you conversations from diverse cybersecurity professionals, ranging from executives, subject matter experts, and aspiring entrants. Today's diverse threat landscape requires systems that can withstand a variety of cyber incidents, remaining trustworthy and secure.
Resilient Cyber is sponsored by Acquia, a cybersecurity service, disabled veteran-owned small business that is passionate about enabling innovation and driving secure digital transformation. Acquia believes in guardrails over roadblocks and security as a business and mission enabler. Learn more at acquia.us. That's A-Q-U-I-A.us. Before we start the episode, we want to give a big thank you to our Season 4 sponsor, Nucleus Security. Meet Nucleus, the only risk-based vulnerability management platform purpose-built for the world's most complex enterprises. Nucleus takes the mountain of vulnerability data that is produced by your security stack and unifies it into one clean dashboard that helps you make sense of your assets and vulnerabilities. With Nucleus, users get a normalized and deduplicated list of vulnerabilities across network devices, cloud, applications, and more. Next, we layer in risk and vulnerability intelligence from sources like Mandiant to help you prioritize the vulnerabilities that matter most. Ready to see how Nucleus can help improve your vulnerability management program? Head to nucleussec.com today.
Thank you for joining the Resilient Cyber Podcast. My name is Chris Hughes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Amit Elazari. Amit, thanks for being here.
Of course, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to chat with you. I've been following your activity recently and, you know, some of the things you're up to with the organization you co-founded, and excited to chat with you. But for folks that don't know you, haven't come across you or any of your work, can you tell us a bit about your background?
Sure, absolutely. Well, it's a pleasure to join you all this sunny morning from California. A little bit about myself. As Chris mentioned, my name is Dr. Amit Elazari. I have been focusing on this intersection between technology and law and government affairs and policy, and specifically on security, for about two decades or so. What you're hearing, the accent is Israeli. So I grew up in Saudi Tel Aviv, came here to do my PhD in technology law at UC Berkeley, and really became fascinated about that connection, right, between technology and law, and learned how laws and regulation can actually be a platform for innovation to grow. So after spending a few years in the legal profession and being an M&A and VC lawyer, I decided that I want to explore more, that I'm more fascinated about shaping laws and policy. Came to Berkeley. While doing my PhD in the law there, I had a lot of honor and privilege to work with amazing hackers. So I actually have some bug bounties of my own, some CVEs of my own, less known, I guess, out there. But really worked with computer scientists and hackers to look at technology issues and what are the legal ramifications. So some of the papers that I've done have resulted with big settlements, tens of millions of dollars in the area of privacy compliance and protecting children online. So that's COPPA. And really, I think the place where I came into security, the kind of junction point where my life changed, was when I was at Berkeley and my amazing sister, a hacker, Karen Elazari, you might know her from her TED Talk as hackers, as the immune system of the internet, told me about the importance of bug bounties and hackers. And I became fascinated with this concept. So I've done what any law student does and started to read tons of contracts, tons of terms of use, and kind of delved into bug bounty contracts and discovered there was more to be done to facilitate protections for hackers and kind of creating a better bridge in terms of the ability of security researchers being able to report vulnerabilities and get paid for them really legally. So that was Disclose.io, my first kind of major initiative in this space. And really the idea was creating more safe harbor protections for researchers. That movement, I would say, with the help of the community and many others, started from an idea in a paper. And in six years became, I think, the most prominent contract being used for bug bounties and vulnerability disclosure programs. And stay tuned. We will talk about the importance of that and why regulators are looking into that as well. Used by thousands of organizations, that research ended up in the Supreme Court decision on the computer anti-hacking landscape, the CFAA, and is now actually required by CISA for all federal agencies. So if Chris, if you have talked here about Secure by Design and Radical Transparency and all the amazing work Jenny Strelley and her team is leading in CISA, one of the things they've done is really cultivating the need to work with the community, and they just released the Vulnerability Disclosure Program report. So worked a little bit on that and got headhunted by Intel. That's the second time things really changed for me. And I got to know policy and the position that I left before joining on Open Policy, which we'll hear a little bit about, is the head of cybersecurity policy at Intel. And I was the chair of the ITI Cybersecurity Committee. So I was in a position to really work at Intel at the highest level, shaping the global regulatory environment, working with governments to educate them on cybersecurity policy, but also doing something really interesting, which is changing the environment to meet Intel. That means giving strategic input on what are going to be the requirements and the controls, not right now, but 2 through 4 years from now, based on policy. Turns out future policies and standards could be a great indication for markets, because that's what's required. We all know in cyber, come on, Chris, you talk with CISOs all the time. 80%, Gartner tells us, is compliance, right? 80% of the decision-making is driven by some sort of regulatory risk or requirements. So if you can get granular and see what technology controls are required, you can know the future of the market. So I had a lot of pleasure and honor to do that for about 4.5 years at Intel, really shaping the environment to meet Intel, shaping Intel to meet the environment, chaired the most, I would say, significant committee when it comes to engaging with government, representing 80 of the largest tech companies, that's ITI and cybersecurity. And then it hit me, Chris, this profession of cyber policy, this highest level, is really small. And our group of professionals, those people that are sitting in that interface between government and future laws and you know, professionals and big technology companies, we are about 200 of us. The intelligence we have in our head about the future of the market, what I just described, is very valuable. And from that vision, from the need to connect better innovators and investment firms with the future of the policy, came Open Policy. We are the world's first tech-enabled platform for policy engagement and intelligence. And our goal is really to connect entities of all size, and we are really focusing on innovative entities, on entrepreneurial companies with policy, and look at future policies as business and market insights and technology market insights. Because as I said, if you can know where regulators are going to take the market, you can design products that are going to be best market fit to meet your customer needs. And we are creating a platform because we think that with, you know, everything you're hearing out there, SEC, executive order, AI, EU Act, everything that we have out there, really to scale and allow those entities to engage, we need a force multiplier. We need a technology. We need that generative AI to look at all the text and allow us to distill out of it what matters, and also create a platform where these innovative entities can come together.
Yeah, you touched on a lot about your background that I didn't even know. And I did a little research coming into this, but you have a fascinating background of the convergence of the legal, the law aspect, the technical aspect with vulnerability disclosure and reporting and CVEs and things like that. And then obviously the convergence of the startup community, the business, technology innovators, and so on. And I agree with you. There's definitely a need to kind of bring those communities together and help drive future regulation. And then obviously, you know, if I'm a startup trying to innovate in this space, produce a product, bring it to market, or I'm a large company that has a massive portfolio of customers already, I need to understand where the regulatory landscape is going. And you kind of opened a can of worms with a phrase you used. You used the term safe harbor. And we've been hearing a lot about, you know, not necessarily safe harbor for security researchers, but we've been hearing conversation around software liability for, you know, technology and software manufacturers and suppliers. And then on the flip side of that, you know, safe harbor for individuals that do take the proper precautions. So I'm curious your thoughts on the conversation that we're hearing around software liability. It got mentioned in the National Cyber Strategy. Right. You know, definitely got a lot of attention. You know, when you talk about liability, all of a sudden everyone's paying attention now. So I'm curious your thoughts on where the conversation's going on that, and, you know, what that may look like as we move forward.
You know, Chris, I love that question because I want to bring our audience first the high level insights on how is this a case study as to what is going on in the regulatory policy conversation and how it's going to impact opportunities specifically for companies that are willing to embrace that, to differentiate and show they're really serious about security, and our innovators. Our innovators that are driving, you know, the solutions to support the organizations, to give them the need and what they need to comply and show, demonstrate that they're complying. So, and, you know, before I would just say at the outset, we just did a podcast. I launched my own podcast inspired by you, Chris, of open policy conversations. And in fact, our first episode was with Jim Dempsey. He's going to lead a lot of that work. And he shared a lot more about it. And we kind of dived into the National Security Strategy Implementation Plan, where it's mentioned. So for our audience interested in software liability, please check that out. It's on our LinkedIn page that Chris, you just kindly shared. So what's the main takeaway? We're just getting started in cybersecurity regulation, just getting started. I don't think we're going to even see the full breadth of market adoption based on regulation until 2 years from now, where we're going to see the implementation of NIS2 already in effect and fines coming in Europe and, you know, really that amazing work being done by administration on the national security strategy and the executive order already being enforced by, you know, federal procurement requirements. And already we have some cases and we have some, you know, auditability. We have some, you know, really robust attestation going on. So, but the shift is very prominent. We are going towards more requirements, more specific, moving the bar from 0 to 1. So if you look, this kind of software liability conversation was, the idea is that today you can waive in your contract, what we call the EULA, like each of us, when we take the software, we all, you know, sign some kind of EULA, right? I accept, right? The biggest lie of the internet. And in that terms of use, you're waiving the warranty, right? You're waiving everything about the software, state and accepting the risk. And that's kind of a binaric approach. You waived it all. And I think where government wants to take us is to a regime where we stop that cheap and patch mentality. And we really take that secure by design culture, the requirements and, you know, the radical transparency, secure by design, everything that CISA and regulators and NIST around the world have been talking about, and pairing it with accountability. And accountability means it's not just when you have the major incident, you know, the solo wins or the major, you know, case, you know, some regulator is going to try to chase you down and give you fine, but rather from, you can't go into the market. You can't even, you know, try to ship that software and waive the liability. So that is a shift towards more accountability, also more technical requirements. Because what does it mean that we are going to have more software liability? It means that you're going to need to show as a manufacturer that you are testing towards certain best practices. Now, this is already the case. Like if you talk with big manufacturers, they're already concerned about class actions, private right of actions. They're already concerned about the FTC going after them, and they want to show they're adhering to best practices. And that's why we have such a vibrant community of innovators that are showing manufacturers and vendor suppliers how they can create solutions that are aligned with NIST best practices, with ISO, with all these standards. But if we have software liability more broadly, that is certainly raising the bar. I think the conversation is going to be how much time it will take. But you're seeing the appetite, even from U.S. government, that this is not the Europeans that are always ahead, always pushing for more regulatory requirements to really move the needle, not just stock, right? Not just release those best practices, but attach to it some certain, you know, some real teeth.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. You touched on a lot of great topics there. We've seen the push from CISA with secure by design, secure by default. We've even seen a shift in the language that we use. We're all used to terms like hardening guides, and they've, you know, kind of picked this anti, you know, counter term that's loosening guide, because we all get a software and we have to harden it. We have to make it secure now because it's kind of open by default and kind of leaves you vulnerable. And then we've seen a conversation, the pushing the burden instead of to consumers and customers, pushing it to those best positioned to do something about it, which is the suppliers and manufacturers. So I think there's a major shift underway in terms of the conversation around software security and safety in the ecosystem. And you're spot on with a lot of your comments. One thing I wanted to ask you is typically there's kind of a divide between, you know, the technology community and the regulatory policymakers. And, you know, I've often heard practitioners on my side, you know, in the community of technology bemoan that, you know, hey, this wasn't written by someone who understands technology. This isn't practical. It's not realistic. They don't know what they're talking about. On that front, you know, how critical is it that we bring like together the technology and practitioner community with the folks writing the policy, you know, leading us towards this future regulatory landscape so that it is practical, it is realistic, but it also has some teeth to it and kind of shifts our current paradigm too.
You know, I love this question, Chris, because it is imperative. And I think it is that imperative. I think it's one of our biggest threats to democracy, because understand that policy, regulation, and it's not even just what's required, it's best practices. You know, people like to talk at high level and messaging and say, you know, we are seeing this narrative, but the implications are real standards that you cannot operate in the market. Like if you look, for example, at Europe, you cannot access the market. You cannot really put your product, literally stops in the custom if you are not going to be aligning yourself with the requirements in the EU Cyber Resilience Act. So the implications for innovation are real. If we are not engaging in the conversation and really talking with policymakers on the reality of how technology operates. So real that, you know, it can be a threat to democracy, because if you think about it, our entire competitiveness as a nation hinges on our technology. And striking that balance of where we should cultivate using regulation, more adoption of security features, all of that is requiring really, especially in security and AI, a really crisp understanding of where the innovation ecosystem is heading, what's the flexibility we need, where are the biggest threats, and how granular should we get when it comes to technology controls. And we are getting a lot more granular. If you look at regulations now, if you look, for example, at the IoT cyber trust mark, it's very specific. What type of controls, what are the technology measures you need to adopt? So in that conversation, we have a responsibility to engage with policymakers. And this is really what led me to open policy. And I want to be very crisp about it. Engaging with policymakers, the first step is the roundtables and the conversations and going to DEF CON and immersing yourself and educating yourself. But the real engagement comes from text. And that's hard work that a lot of people don't do, because it requires very unique expertise. I'm talking about creating comments, sending comments, building the right consensus to engage so the comment has that broad sense of support, tracking all these different documents, persistently filing the comments, and doing the conversation. So that is the reason why we started Open Policy, because I know even from my background that with all, you know, the power of Intel, and we really had an amazing team, it's like a DDoS. It's a denial of service attack of regulation. And we don't have good tools to take that expertise of how to really focus and engage and prioritize, which, as I shared, has maybe 200 people in the world that do it, and connected to the blue ocean of innovators. So if we really wanted to engage, and we are constantly telling, you know, professionals, engage, educate, and we have that lack of education and awareness, it's not just going to be the same thing we've been doing over and over for years. It's not going to be just the people-to-people conversation, which is important. It's the coming to DEF CON, all the work being done. We have to have better tools. And that is where I believe that, you know, we are stepping in, because our goal is to create the technology to assist in those critical issues. We are really focusing first on awareness and intelligence, why this matters, not even engagement, just taking all the text and taking out of it, you know, the technology controls that are going to be required, positioning it as a business development capability, and then creating a platform where entities that are focused on a sole topic, think about IoT security. All the entities or some of the entities that are focused on one topic can come together and spread the cost of engagement and have a much more powerful voice. So it's imperative, but we have to have tools that make it economic for investment firms and innovative entities and startups to engage, because we can talk about how important that is forever. But if we don't create a path for effective engagement, then what are we really doing?
Yeah, you said a few things that I wanted to emphasize that I think are so critical is, you know, I spend a lot of time reading these documents and diving into this, and it's a lot to try to keep up with or synthesize. And if you're coming from a different background, like investment, for example, or venture capital, or you're a technology startup and you're focused on speed to market, development, innovation, you know, customer demand, you don't necessarily have the time or bandwidth to kind of dive into these hundreds or thousands of pages of regulatory, you know, developments and nuanced text. So I think having this pathway, this that kind of can bring that information together, kind of, make the emphasis on what's critical, what do you need to take away from this, what do you need to be thinking about as you move forward, is so important. And you also mentioned, the U.S. Cyber Trust Mark program that you were involved in, which I was going to ask you about next. This one I found interesting because, you know, it's often kind of quipped that cybersecurity is a market failure, or that, you know, the right incentives aren't in place for consumers to make risk-informed purchasing decisions, for example. The average consumer is not a cybersecurity expert. They're not going to understand the nuances of MFA and, you know, zero trust architecture and all these kind of things. But I think this program is interesting because it brings a labeling kind of paradigm, as I understand it, to help consumers make those risk-informed purchasing decisions and kind of, put their money where they feel safe in terms of labeling. And I think this is a great way to drive those market incentives. So can you tell us a bit about that, you know, that Cyber Trust Mark program and your involvement in it and how it came about?
Yeah, fantastic. And for our audience, again, on our page, and you can obviously feel free to link it, we have created an animation, and it's common, like it's Creative Commons. Everybody can use it. You know, it's an animation that describes the journey of the user. We did a wonderful video that we presented both the animation and the video in the White House. So those resources that delve into the topic and kind of explain it more are available to you on our LinkedIn page. So let's dive in. And Chris, you're spot on. The whole idea is to create more salience of security features. So the term salience, and, you know, I'm a lawyer and, you know, I love geeking out on terms in the law, but it really is really important for security. The term salience means an ability, really looking at something, distilling it to the extent that it changes your purchase decision-making. So it's not just reading it and not caring about it. It's reading it and now it is actually changing the consumer decision. And what we're trying to do is to create a pathway where the complex and kind of robust environment of security empowers users to make decisions, which means we have to really simplify it for them. So that's what we're doing with the label. So two things. First of all, again, I wanted to connect it to the theme. What's the theme? We regulators are moving to measurable, demonstrable, specific security, not just, you know, trust me. You know, trust me, I'm the manufacturer. Trust me, I have this. But rather, one of the things that is happening with the label is there's going to be a lot of attestation of third party. If the manufacturer is putting the label and then, you know, for some reason is falling out of the state of secure posture, you know, the barcode is going to show that it's no longer in that state. There's going to be I think it's going to cultivate a lot more testing around it. And really the standard community is starting to work on that, you know, on an automatic ledger, right, to streamline all of that. So we are moving towards a lot more measurable, demonstrable third-party certification, okay, regime when it comes to security. Europe is there already, you know, with the EU Cyber Resilience Act, with certifications under the EU Cyber Security Act. That's takeaway number one. Takeaway number two, which really I am very passionate about because I spent years on IoT security and editing a standard in that space and ISO, is product security regulation. We have been so focused on enterprise, and we had a couple of laws in IoT, like the California law, but it's really, it was just focusing on, you know, no default password. You're going to see such a focus on product security regulation, and that's going to be a real opportunity for many players. You know, we came to the White House for the first time, you know, supporting and bringing the statements of support of companies like Armis and Exonius and Cybeats and FireDX. And, you know, it was really great to see how these companies are coming together to support the administration. So the label is getting going. We have an NPRM out. We have this rulemaking from the FCC that is asking really critical questions like what's the scope, what's the measures, which standards, and that's something we open policy are planning to engage with our partners. And in addition to that, once, you know, I think in a couple of the months, we will start to see that really that rollout, right, of the labels. And it's going to be both online and in stores, in the retail store. So the vision is you come into the store and you see that CyberTrust mark, right, that is already marked and filed with the USPTO, with the Office for the Trademarks in the United States. And you can scan the barcode and see what's the state of the device. What that means is the device has been equipped, if it's a consumer IoT device, that doorbell, that smart doorbell has been equipped with a set of security features. Now, Chris, you're probably wondering, but how can I know which features? Because, hey, that's a big opportunity for my startups. If I know what are the controls that all the CISOs in the area of manufacturing of IoT are going for. So great question. That's why I'm saying regulations are becoming, you know, very technical. So that's coming from a body of work that NIST has been doing, right, for years, and specifically NIST 8425, which is the set of guidelines for consumer IoT. And these are controls like have security updates, state the period of support, have protection of data, you know, in transit, in rest. Like it gets very, very granular. So NIST 8425 would be the backbone, but on top of it, we have a lot of standards where we're in development. So very critical effort, raising the bar, raising the baseline security measures in all devices, getting technically granular, also has process requirements. So does the manufacturer have a vulnerability disclosure program, right? Does it, you know, do we have SDL? Do we have, you know, this, you know, even SBOMs and this idea of asset identifications are spelled out there. So very interesting to see that. And I think my one thing that I will say to the audience is there is this tendency to think that regulations are staying in one area. You know, this is voluntary, but it's starting in consumer IoT, but already the FCC is asking, well, what should we do? What about the scope? What about the other areas of IoT? And the White House said, well, we're also going to be doing something really big in industrial in the area of energy. So, you know, always take this something that is happening in the regulation space as something that is starting in one domain, but certainly would bleed elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. A few things that I want to point out that you brought up that I thought are fascinating is historically, like you said, when we talk about cybersecurity, it's always been focused on the enterprise, never the consumer necessarily. You know, when we talk about products or secure, you know, software products, but now these things pervade our everyday life, everything we do from leisure activities to critical infrastructure, national security. And you also pointed out earlier how you know, having a digital innovation is critical to national security too. We talk about, you know, many people in my area of expertise talk about how, you know, kind of this fifth domain of cybersecurity being part of modern digital warfare. And I wanted to ask you that, you know, kind of a follow-up question on that note is, you know, many people, as soon as they hear the word regulation, they automatically think it's going to stifle innovation. It's going to drag us to a halt. And hey, a lot of my work has been in the defense sector where it is heavily regulated. And sometimes, you know, it can seem like we're doing things for the sake of doing them. And there is fear that, you know, we'll stifle innovation and be unable to compete with, you know, near peer foreign adversaries, for example. And so, you know, my question is, how do we balance, you know, the regulatory push, protect consumers, you know, protect, you know, users, enterprise environments, et cetera, but also not stifle economic and, you know, national security when we talk about innovation on the digital front?
That's a great question. I think what we need to understand is, to do that, there are some principles that we have been following as a community, you know, and talk a lot about when we talk with regulators, but there is also an issue of the platform. So every big attack follows with a wave of regulation. If actually, if you want to predict the market, you can literally see an attack, like let's take SolarWinds, Log4j, you know where the focus is going to be. Supply Mirai, default password, botnets, and IoT, right? You know, Log4j, software bill of materials, open source security, right? You can actually see that. The issue is to strike that balance between stifling innovation, but also promoting the type of innovations that we need by A, protecting the nations and making sure that as manufacturers, as, you know, as we create innovation, we don't create a technical debt, right? Which is really important. Striking that balance is a lot about that engagement. And if you think about being in the position of the government, like the government has just as much, you know, professionals they can put in that space. And they've been doing, like the U.S. government has been doing amazing work trying to bring those innovators in, whether it's the, you know, FACA, so that's advisory boards, you know, you see it with CISA, where it's an, you know, innovator resident, the work by NIST. a lot of work trying to bring the private sector in, but they have so many professionals. It's about, we have an imperative, right, to engage, and that engagement needs to move on from just talking, which is really important. It needs to be actual writing, showing the technology, you know, persistent engagement, I want to call it. And to do that, we need a platform because the issues are going to continuously change. So for, you know, it could be engagement right now. It's generative AI. How can we equip regulators and policymakers with the best understanding of the threats and how we should operate in the steps so we operate in the space so we continue to innovate? Because remember, if we don't innovate, if we don't innovate right, we are in a competitive disadvantage with China, with others, right? There are true economic national security implications of not leveraging the innovation because the attackers, the adversaries are using the innovation. So to do that, we need a better platform so we can actually have that persistent engagement. The other side of it is speaking with regulators and policymakers in a language they can understand, give them actionable solutions. A lot of the times I see, you know, people coming in and they're complaining, which is important. Like, we should share our views, but we really need to find compromise. We really need to give them solutions that are addressing their needs, addressing the nation needs, but on the other side, striking that balance. And it's an art. That's part of why I'm passionate about open policy, because it's some form of art. You know, we've been doing this for years. We've been writing those comments. And even for us, it's, you know, it's constantly a journey. So to do that better, we believe there is an element of the crowd, a little bit like security. We're going to be constantly in the journey of like being in the dialogue, scanning the dialogue, bring more innovative players to the table. But it is a balance. And the best way to do it, I think, is that persistent engagement. I also really encourage people to get into the weeds. The high level conversations are important, but if you really want to try to drive something, you got to get technical. You got to engage on these documents. You got to work in the standard space. You really have to, you know, get into the weeds of the controls and starting immersing yourself. And we are there to help with that. And finally, I would say, and this is maybe my most, I don't want to call it controversial, but this is really one of my out of the box messages. We got to embrace the power of technology. People like to think that, you know, innovation and policy are stifling, policy stifling innovation. Let me ask you, Chris, what is the single most prominent body of policy that drove copyright law enforcement? What do you think?
I couldn't necessarily guess. I'm curious to see what the answer is, though.
Digital rights management. You see, policy creates innovation. Everything we're pursuing right now on AI, with the executive order on the AI, that is, we're going to see it soon. Like, you know, everybody's talking about it. My prediction, October, January, it's going to create, you know, push for specific technologies in AI, right? We're seeing the language around watermarking. We are seeing the language around all these areas. Policy is driving innovation because many times it is because of the requirements that the regulators and the policymakers are, putting in the law or putting in the standards, we then see the need to create solutions to allow organizations to comply. Think about the SBOM, right? And what better example than encryption or digital rights management? You know, that body of technology is perhaps the single most powerful enforcer of law. So if you start thinking about technology as policy, which is, by the way, not my term. If our audience wants to get philosophical, they can go, you know, read Professor Lessig's amazing book, Code. If you start thinking about how things are really getting enforced at scale in the world, that's technology. Technology is probably the most robust mechanism to govern. And that means that innovators have a lot of power. They have a lot of power because they're designing solutions that could be more powerful than policy, because that's de facto. Think about encryption. What a great example, right? Encryption, hard to circumvent end to end. What does it mean, right? For accessing the data, for data, for privacy, right? Very powerful. So innovators have a role to play here, and it's an imperative on all of us to get more engaged. And I think that's the only way to strike the balance. There is no one, you know, tool, because for each domain, we're going to need to strike a different balance. We have to make sure we engage to get it right.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize a few things you said, and I think you're incredibly spot on. Is like, you know, first off, is regulatory reaction. Regulatory things are often reactionary, but you can tell it's a signal of what's to come. Like you talked about, whether it's proprietary software like SolarWinds incidents, open source software incidents like Log4j, you can kind of see where we're headed, right? And kind of, you know, honestly, predict the future, but get a pretty good idea of where things are headed. And then also, you emphasize the need to get engaged and involved and get in the weeds. If you're a technologist, you know, you got to get down to the nitty gritty of these policy documents and regulatory efforts, understand really what they're trying to accomplish, how they're trying to go about it, because it's going to impact you from a tech, if you're working on technology and products and software, for example. And then on the policymaker front, of course, you got to understand the technology that you're trying to govern. You can't really create policy for something that you just don't understand. It's not going to have the intended impact that you're after. Right. So definitely it's imperative for both sides to get engaged and get into the weeds. And I think that's why what you're doing is so fascinating. It kind of gives people the tools, whether you're coming from this, you know, the software supplier, product company perspective, innovator perspective, or the policymaker perspective. And I think that's why, you know, what you're doing is really fascinating. I wanted to ask, you know, as a closing question for folks that, you know, want to learn more about open policy, what you guys are doing, how to get involved, whether they're on the regulatory front or a company, a product company, software company, you know, where can they start?
Yeah, fantastic. And I'm really appreciative. And I think you nailed it, Chris. And I would say one of the most interesting audience that is approaching us and we're working with is investment firms. Investment firms, VCs, you know, they're investing in AI security now. And like, turns out that this future policy landscape, if you can predict it and also engage on it, like making sure that it's going the right way, you can increase your TAM, you can predict your TAM. And future policies become this very clear indicators, right, of where the market is going to go. Now, remember, all of us on the line, like, you are designing, if you're an innovator, even if you're a unicorn already, even if you're, you know, a growth company, you are still doing R&D. You're still designing products for the future. Even for today, you need to know better than your customer what's going to meet their, you know, demand, what they need. And this is where, at least in certain areas like privacy, security, AI, regulation turns out is a very accurate and powerful tool. And especially if you're designing for the future, you cannot afford to not know what the future is. So that's where we fit in. We are just getting started. So we are very, it's hard to believe open policy only exists like 3 months because we've been overwhelmed and really excited about, you know, the traction. And, you know, I guess the time has come. Unicorns and startups are ready to engage on this topic, which is very humbling. And we are very fortunate to have this support. At this stage, we're developing the technology. We are actually fundraising a little bit, and we are also creating our first coalitions, and we already have customers. So we are starting to create those coalitions that are very focused on topics, product security, AI security, AI governance, open source security, critical infrastructure, OT. These are certainly areas where we operate. So if you're an innovator in that space or interested in it, please reach out. And as I shared, we are already working with design partners that want to start working with us closely on the platform. You know, from our perspective, the tool we're trying to create that distills all of that noise into very actionable, you know, business and technology trends has not been created. So we are taking the time to work with our partners to build the right platform. And if you're interested in something like this, a tool that allows you to better understand what's coming, but also creates a path to engagement, just reach out. Please reach out. You know, you can go on our website. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I will just say that, you know, we are not doing this alone. I'm very fortunate to have an amazing team. We're just getting started, but we have our business development and operation lead, Natalie, and we have my co-founder, Didi Uzan, David Uzan, second timer, already built the amazing technology for Blaze Vault. So turned the company into, you know, tens of millions in revenue. And I think there are almost 500,000 users for that product. So we are very fortunate to have a team that we are just looking to grow. So please do reach out. We are on a mission here to democratize access to policy. So we need your help.
Yeah, well said. So we covered so many areas. You know, we're talking about secure by design, secure by default, making security and privacy a competitive differentiator, enabling, you know, innovators and technology startups and policymakers with the tools to kind of move beyond talk to actual engagement and involvement. So a lot of exciting stuff. And I definitely appreciate your time, Dr. Al-Azhari, and hope you have a great weekend. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you so much, Chris. Appreciate your time this morning and have a wonderful weekend to our live audience. And looking forward to engage with you all.
Take care, everyone.